cigarettes and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true.
Breathe the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
This is for soldiers who bust their guns in the name of freedom, not the game of funds. True queens who raise their kids, implement the knowledge, show them how to live. This is for those who stand in line to feed their babies while we're
Welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are live in studio with Spitfire hosts Victoria, that's me, Mercedes, Gao, and Alyssa.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of things this month, we want to thank all the folks out there who pledged to CKUT, and especially those of you who pledged to Spitfire. We've got another jam-packed show this month.
Hey y'all, Gao here. I'll be doing a quick report back on this year's Culture Shock event series at McGill and try to bring some strategies for healing rage to the table.
I'll be looking into the sudden trend of Little Burgundy becoming known as one of Montreal's sudden quote-unquote hotspots of 2014 and the role that gentrification has played in the development of its sudden popularity.
Also, we have a special treat for our Spitfire listeners with an extended Things We Love November edition, where Spitfire hosts get to share their favorite bits of culture from this past month. I'll be focusing on Ferguson.
Yes.
And I don't love that.
She's awfully prepared for this.
Thanks, Alyssa. Thanks for the heads up. All that and more coming right up on Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
What's the next song?
The one about me.
Oh, yeah. I like this one.
What?
Like Jenny said.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
Uh.
You don't know what you've got till it's gone.
just fuck with it for a minute.
What?
Now you realizing when them nights go long, right? It ain't for me to say when you know that I'm gone, right? You act all wild when I tell you to settle. I was working around the clock with your girls on the metal. Talk about I heard you swims with the chick on the beach. That was out with the tide, but my love you impeach. Now you looking at the walls, head and hand, Cole Jonesing. Rigging my house, hanging up and imposing. Now why you wanna go and do that, love, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, love, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, love, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, love, huh? Now why you wanna go and do that, Joni Mitchell never lies,
You don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Yo, do you feel that?
It is 6:09 on Wednesday, November 26th. That was Gone Till It's Gone by Janet Jackson featuring Q-Tip. We are broadcasting live on CKUT. This is Spitfire Woman of Color Radio. Mercedes is going to speak some truth now about gentrification in this city. Mercedes.
Thank you, Alyssa. So, as I usually start off my ramblings on this show, I'm usually on Facebook.
Not rambling.
Thank you.
They're spitting fire in succinct, organized
ways. What we're here for. So, as I was browsing through my Facebook newsfeed, as I sometimes do when avoiding responsibilities, I came across an article on one of my friends that one of my friends had posted on her page. As a proud Berg's resident, I wasn't surprised that she had posted it. However, I was surprised by the title of the article. Quote, Montreal's Little Burgundy named the city's hottest new neighborhood. .. Oh yeah, and Milex too. Close quote. It was an article posted on the infamous Montreal blog, a social media platform that gives us the 411 on what's good or not in Montreal. It was regaling us about the trip Boston Globe author Christopher Muther had taken to Montreal and how he realized how Mile X and Little Burgundy had become the buzzing hangouts in the city. Now, I could not really be concerned about Mile X. Let me rephrase. I was not concerned about the rising popularity of Mile X, one, because I don't live there. Two, it's not an area I frequent enough to confirm or deny its rise to fame. But I was troubled by the fact that people are suddenly discovering what an amazing neighborhood Little Burgundy is based on the fact that it has been and it continues to be gentrified. For those of you unfamiliar with the term gentrification, it is the process or renewal and rebuilding accompanying the influx of middle-class or affluent people into deteriorating areas that often displaces poorer residents. That I got from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Thank you, Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Now, I am not saying that Little Burgundy is a deteriorating neighborhood, but there has been an influx of high-end condos going up, as well as the expulsion of established businesses to be replaced by popular chain restaurants, cafes, and stores that do not benefit the community. If I see one more bakery, bar, or coffee shop go up in my neighborhood, I'm going to lose it, and that's a promise. More and more, what we see is predominantly white clientele frequenting these establishments and the erasure of the cultural diversity that other businesses fostered. That, and unless you can afford a $6 coffee or a 45-plus meal, you definitely do not reap the benefits of having such establishments go up just around the corner. The article starts off by saying, quote, keeping track of the IT neighborhood is pretty hard in Montreal. St. Henry used to be the latest borough to be in. So did Mile End. And now Little Italy is looking to be the hippest hood. Little Burgundy is looking to be the hippest hood. Until then, though, two Montreal neighborhoods will enjoy their time in the spotlight, as even American writers have become aware of their awesomeness, with the Boston Globe citing Little Burgundy and Mile X as Montreal's hottest new hoods. Excuse me? Hottest new hoods? Quite frankly, I'm just tired of hipsters running around my neighborhood acting like they've discovered a whole new cool and unique place. My neighborhood is not part of a trend, it's an original statement. Another part that irked me was the second paragraph. As you can see, I'm not off to a good start in this article. Saying, quote, citing the recent upsurge of trendy 20-somethings that have dominated both areas as the reason for the LG and Mile X's newfound glamour, in parentheses, which we can't deny. One can't talk about Little Burgundy without mentioning Joe Beef, the Lachine Canal Grinder, or Tuck Shop, B-Tuck, Evo, and Drinkery. Yes, these are places that are found in Little Burgundy on Notre Dame West Street, if any of you are interested. But they are all, with the exception of Joe Beef, which has been there forever, newly built restaurants created to attract a certain clientele and spiff up the joint. These are places where, rather than people automatically assuming they're going into a ghetto, which I've heard on multiple occasions, they are now going to frequent a popular waterhole. Give me a break. The cherry on the cake is the last portion of the review on Mother's experience. And I quote, "For an American, Mother does a pretty good job of describing the vibe of both neighborhoods, though he's pretty much just telling us what we already know, namely that Little Burgundy and Mile X are the latest greatest places to live, dine, or go out in Montreal at the moment. Who is this we? What does anyone know about living in Little Burgundy unless you've lived there and actually have been in the neighborhood for more than the duration of a meal or a drink? Little Burgundy has history, a story, a soul. It's more than a place to be at the moment. It's not only a place you can call home or a place to spend an evening out with friends and make memories. It's a place that is timeless. Despite my ramblings, I am proud as a resident to have an article posted about my neighborhood. Just don't call the influx of white business owners the reason why people want to come to Little Burgundy. But what I cannot stand is the misrepresentation of what makes it a hot place to be. It was hot before this article was put out, and it will be hot 20 years from now."
Snap.
Hey, did you grow up in Little Burgundy?
Yep, all my life. Oh, so I lived there. So I've watched it change in certain directions. Yeah. But I mean it's home. Like, I understand, like, things need to develop, but at the same time, I just don't understand why people are calling it new. Mm. You know, it's not.
Who are these people who are obsessed with finding, like, the it place? Like, how is that your basis for traveling? Like, you go to a place and you're like, I want to find the trendy neighborhood. That's such a weird, like,
it's accumulation of, like, social capital, though. I mean,
that too. And I feel it's just like you're appropriating somebody else's neighborhood at the same time. It's like, it's not yours to decide what's cool or not. And it's not your place either.
It's like this weird paradox where the gentrification very often happens on top of a historic kind of community of color or communities of color. True. So there's this weird paradox of, like, you want to go to where the brown people are, mm-hmm. but you want to displace them, but you still want to retain the authenticity of what made that neighborhood cool in the first place. So it's mm-hmm. like the social capital, as Gao was saying, but it's, like, packaged and, like, resold for a profit as opposed to just people living and being. It's so weird.
Yeah, it is.
It's slumming without the slum, basically.
Yeah.
Also, like, we should note the kind of weird, I always want to talk about French nationalism and, like, working class history, in the sense that, like, you know, like, when we talk about gentrifying neighborhoods in Montreal, there comes a kind of baggage of talking about, you know, French Canadian working class neighborhoods mm-hmm. being also gentrified and part of this process. But you know what, let's just push that aside and talk about people of color for once, because really I'm kind of tired of this victimization speech. Like, mm-hmm. I'm really done with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. What do you mean? You mean, like, that French working class people also claim to be gentrified?
Well, yeah, no, and that's totally, like, a valuable argument. It's just, like, it completely overrides the fact that, like, people of color are also being displaced. So you kind of had this, like, spiel about, Anglophones taking over the neighborhood and displacing French people, but it's, like, you know.
But you're also doing the displacing at the same time to, like, make space for your own victimization kind of thing.
Right.
But you're also, like, still victimizing those who are quote-unquote victims.
No, I just remember being so cheesed because, like, Notre Dame West used to have this boss roti place, and it's gone. I think now there's, like, some douchey art gallery.
Oh my god, that art gallery is so lame.
There's, like, five art galleries. I remember one time I got into a big fight with my boo and I just wanted roti, so I hopped on the cab, went to this roti place, and it was gone.
No, it's
and I
so mad. It's a reoccurring problem because one minute you'll see a store there, someplace you're like, oh, okay, you know, I might go try this place out. And the next thing you know, it's a muffin shop. And you're just like, why is there a muffin shop here? Why isn't there something useful that I can
muffins
go to?
Muffins aren't that filling.
Well, even self, if they're not filling, it's like, why? What's the use? There's like three of them, like two doors over.
And they treat you badly.
And it's
like,
ridiculous.
I feel like every time I walk into one of those bougie, clearly hipster establishments, I get treated so poorly. It's like, why are you here?
It's kind of like you're dressed judgment.
Like, you're not wearing complete skinny jeans and some like, I don't know, some glasses that
for
we
sure.
all have.
For
I
sure.
can't handle it.
And like, what I don't like is the fact that they're also kind of overshadowing kind of like the, I don't know, I want to call them black hair salons. I guess we could call
why
them.
Why can't you call them
like,
that?
I don't know if
it's like a legitimate
I don't
term.
Know. Okay, it is. Okay, I don't know.
You've been in Canada for too long, girl.
I was just going to call it a barbershop. But
black
in any case,
salon.
It's just...
Black
yeah,
hair
okay.
salons that do black hair.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, okay. Like, I don't know if there's... I don't know. Anyway, moving on.
You live in Canada
on.
For too long.
I okay, know, no, been, but... But it's like they're all being pushed out by, like, these main, like, high-end hair salons where it's, like, three chairs and then it's, like, $150 to cut your hair.
Have you seen...
Like, what?
Have you seen the black hair salon that is bougie?
No, which one?
There's one.
Oh yeah, Simi was telling us about it.
It is so bougie.
It's in St. Henry, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's like at Lionel Grew. Like the major intersection is Lionel Grew and Notre Dame, and it's like bougie. It's like white lights and everything.
Oh,
beautiful
the one
logo.
That deals with like natural hair. I forget the name.
Yeah, they do natural.
It's like
hair.
Hairspiration or something. Yeah, like that.
But they're like Jasma in Toronto, but they're really good. I want to go there. I'm just saying.
They know what they're doing, but unfortunately, like, they're trying to keep up with what the look is on that street, which is unfortunate because it kind of forces them to have like a certain image that they may not have wanted.
But what's the price point?
It depends. I think it really depends on the condition of your hair because that's how they base it on.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like this whole movement of going back to like your natural hair. So if people go in with like perms, it's like they tell you what to do in order to kind of grow it out properly, and then trim, slip, slip, like refresh your hair, all that.
I love anyway. How a convo about gentrification turned into black hair. This is why our show
it's just
is
as
the
important.
Best.
It's just as important. But anyway, that's me. Thank you for listening.
Thanks Mercedes.
Mercedes.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color
we
in Montreal.
We need to speak our truths
events,
and to say no to the silencing of our voices
rage,
in a racist and sexist
joy,
society.
Spoken word. Interview.
What's that?
Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
A rock, or I should say.
say a boulder rolling down your neck, pounding on your shoulders. Never shall I be an MC called a wannabe. I am the light, L-Y-T-E. This is the way it is, don't ever forget. Hear the rhyme of someone else and you know they've been all in the way, just little obstacles. Chew them up, spit them out, just like popsicles. Suckers out of my way, we're not on the same wavelength. I show stability, potential, and strength. On the other hand, you are weak and unruly. You never be a spy cause you're just a plain stoolie. I am the light, I'm a slave, I'm a slave, I'm a slave to the rhythm. Death rhymes on the microphone is what I'm giving. Yes, I am a rock and you are just a pebble. Milk turn up the bass and rock adjust the levels. If a rap can paint 1,000 words, then I can paint 1,000,000. Wait, light is capable of painting up 1,000,000,000 raps. And when I say it, this is what I mean. 4002 and the alliance on the scene. And I like to say what's up to my producer, King of Chill. Party people, are you ready? Jam if you will. Never underestimate Light DMC. I am a rapper who is here to make things the way they're meant to be. The word ultimate, I'm here to take the title. But I had a little trouble upon my arrival. But I got rid of those who tried to rock me. Light is here, no one can stop me. I am the light. There are hip-hop leaders, this you know. We also have hip-hoppers that follow. By the tone of my voice, you can tell I am a scholar. I'm also the leader of the hip-hop followers. Now get this, I'm at a jam and I'm rocking it. Suckers like a checkerboard, red, black is clocking it. The graces, I ease across the stage, bars around the audience, sort of like a cage. They laugh, cause they assume I'm in prison, but in reality, they're locked in. Once again, I'll state that I can't be stopped for show. I am as light as I am the light rock. L-Y-L-L-Y-T, I am the light.
Do you understand the metaphoric phrase, light as a rock? It's explaining how heavy the young lady is. You know what I'm saying, King?
Yes, my brother, but I would consider light as a rock a simile because of the usage of the word as. And now, directly from the planet of Brooklyn, MC Light as a rock.
Yo, we're back.
Hey. That was Light as a Rock by MC Light. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Spitfire, a monthly radio show hosted by women of color on CKUT 90.3 FM. Always get those decimal places mixed up, even in elementary school. Anyway, I'm actually up next with a piece on Culture Shock. I don't know, for those of you that don't know, Culture Shock is an annual series held by Cupid McGill. It basically demystifies race, indigeneity, refugee status, and migrancy. I'm going to start with a preface because I know I felt like being a bit wordy today. I'm a student at McGill, and this fact carries a lot of weight. At McGill, Canada's colonial legacy seeps into the soil, into the roots, into the land. It seeps into my thoughts. It is embedded in the very weapons, the rhetoric, the discourse I try to use against it in vain. And each time, I feel too weak, too slow, and too stagnant. And yet, I speak this way because I can't quite remember the violence of the past. My first stop at Culture Shock was Shana Agbayani's documentary on race at McGill. Technical difficulties aside, the film gave voice to a lot of concerns for that people of color at McGill feel. McGill flaunts itself as kind of multicultural, and I think that it does this only as a badge of cosmopolitanism. Alyssa, I'm sure you feel this when you look around McGill. You don't see much representation in the way of people of color, nor indigenous folk. Whiteness basically pervades the campus. And I think what's most striking about the documentary were the segments that spoke to the utter lack of representation of POCs and indigenous people, both on the level of mental health services at McGill, as well as the professional faculty. Mental health professionals that identified as people of color, specifically women of color, were the most attractive candidates for positions at McGill's counseling service, and yet they all declined their offers because they would rather work at a campus where they felt that their kind of work would be reflected in the population. So hence they thought that McGill wasn't representative enough of the kind of services they could provide, and they didn't think that students could basically benefit from that kind of service, whereas at Concordia they probably would, because apparently Concordia is a lot more diverse than McGill, and that's a real shame. On the campus that boasts diversity, there are also no tenured professors of color, and so not only is this an absolute shame, it's also irresponsible of McGill. I mean, not every person at McGill is convinced. Race is refutable to some, and the myth of the model minority coaxes us into disillusionment. But I just wanted to take a second to kind of like acknowledge the kind of role we have at this institution in being a part of this legacy, and like the fact that like we are settlers on this land as well is like a huge thing that goes unnamed, unnoticed. And I don't know, like culture shock really kind of brought that to my attention more and made me more aware of that, because like I'm not completely cleared of my privilege despite like me being essentially like marginalized at this school. Right now, I'll just jump to the most powerful part of the series that I attended, which was the keynote done by Dark Matter. Dark Matter is a South Asian trans art activist duo that creates a tapestry of words that interweaves themes of race, gender, sexuality, nationalism, patriarchy, and colonialism into poetry and polemic. That was actually the most touching part of the entire series. I had to hold it back. I was like, Gao, you cannot cry is like the first poem. Like, you cannot do it. And, you know, like Malek, who is our Spitfire alumni, she was just like wooing and like, as Malek is all I like want to do. She was just like sighing, and I was just like, right on you, Malek. It was incredible. We're going to try to play you a piece from Dark Matter a bit later. Hopefully we'll have time for that. I just want you guys to hear everything for yourself. And the last thing that I attended was Healing Rage, which was a person of color and indigenous identified only space, which was incredible in that, you know, usually at the events at Culture Shock, white people are invited. There was, with the exception of one called Giving Birth to Yourself, which I heard was amazing, but I didn't get to catch. So I went to Healing Rage a bit late, and when I got there, it was really a beautiful kind of atmosphere to arrive in. There was just food, there was just people everywhere. It was like, it felt like a community for once, which I haven't felt for, I don't think, my entire time of staying in Montreal. We started off after lunch with a performance done between a woman, an Indigenous woman, and a Haitian woman. So it was kind of bridging that solidarity between two cultures. And I thought that was kind of a big theme of Culture Shock. And maybe we could talk a bit about that, like POC and indigeneity in solidarity. POC and Indigenous people in solidarity, rather. And also using art to kind of embody that solidarity and to kind of fight against oppression. So I was wondering if you guys had any ideas about how we could reclaim our bodies, our identities, our histories from the legacy of colonialism.
Two minutes, go.
Well, can I just say that I remember, Victoria, when we had that discussion about, are we settlers? Because...
Oh, yeah, and you, like, got mad at me.
I didn't get mad at you.
Cried. Oh, that's why you were, like, not looking down. I was saying...
No. I'm kidding.
I, like, because there's this article by... but is it Benita Lawrence and Amadahe? Lawrence and Amadahe. It's called Indigenous People and Black People in Canada, Settlers or Allies. I think that's the title. It's a really good... It came out in, like, 2009. But so they kind of explore this point of convergence and also the friction between Indigenous people and Black people specifically. But I think a lot of the arguments apply to people of color who either grow up here or who are brought here or whose parents are come here, and then they have kids, and then you're a person of color growing up in Canada. Because, I mean, obviously I'll speak for myself. I am not Indigenous to Canada. But does the lack of indigeneity mean that you're a settler if you're still impacted by colonialism, and if your people have been impacted by colonialism? I mean, in the debate that Victoria and I had, I feel like I was much more reconciled with the fact that I guess I have to be like a settler to a certain extent, right? Because I'm participating in the Canadian state. I have Canadian citizenship. My mom is white and descends from Europe, three or four generations, I think. So I have to at least like identify with that. But I mean, as a black woman in Canada, I feel like a settler. Like, what am I? You know what I mean? Like, it's not okay. That simple.
Yes. Yeah. In terms of my background, like, I feel like I'm a descendant of like forced migrant labor, you know, displaced from various imperialistic, colonialisms that happened in Korea as well as in the Philippines for how many hundreds of years. So it's really hard to take on the responsibilities of what it means to be part of the settler colonial state here. And so it's a really, I think it's an amazing thing to articulate that challenge. What like your process of decolonization looks like from, you know what I mean? So that's why I was like, you guys have to go to this conference because I was out of town and it looked really interesting. And yeah, like what are the next steps kind of like what?
I mean, well, what was kind of talked about was kind of just like, okay, I'll give you the example of the Algonquin community adopting Haitians into the community. And so that was kind of like this focal point of like one of the workshops that I talked to that I attended, and also a part of Healing Rage, the beginning portion was a talk about that. And so I just feel like, yeah, underlined in this is perhaps that kind of like bridging the gap between different people and different cultures and kind of like coming together in a sense, despite that. I mean, I'm still stuck on like not being a settler, because like I agree with what you're saying, and that's the way I always thought about it. Like that's the way I always thought about like my own history, but at the same time I can't help but feel like I need to at a certain point take some responsibility in what's happening currently.
Definitely.
Even if like our ancestors didn't like,
for sure. Yeah. And because you have privilege, you have more power, and therefore you have more responsibility to represent. I just want to know what that looks like. You know, it's like a list of actions.
I don't know what that looks like at all. I went to, like, the only parts of Healing Rage that talked about that I think I wasn't in. Like, I was in a workshop about, like, food from our like homelands or something like that. It was I forget what it was called, and I mean it was kind of wishy-washy. I don't want to say that, maybe I shouldn't say that. I didn't feel like I was tackling anything. Like I wasn't
surface level.
Yeah, it was like kind of, it wasn't like too surface level, but I didn't feel like I was getting the tools to kind of start detangling the whole mess. You know, I felt like it was we start from ourselves, we try to like understand where we came from, but then after that there's just absence. Like we just talk about where we came from, that's where the discussion stops.
I just want to say to our listeners who are just tuning in, it's Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 6:36, and we're having a roundtable discussion that is mediated by Gao on an amazing conference called Culture Shock, Healing Rage, that took place a couple weeks ago. So
maybe we could actually, I'm sorry, I couldn't answer your question. Also, I don't have the answer to this question. This is so scary. Oh my God, how do you decolonize? I have no idea. I'm so dumb.
Stop pressuring her. Do you want to talk about like McGill campus and like whiteness? I had a comment.
Yeah. Go for it.
Let's talk about it.
Like waiting to talk.
Well, I just wanted to say, and Victoria again has like awesome vocabulary that she gets stuck on me. And one of the terms she brought to my attention was third world elite. Now I say it like at least once a day. But I feel like that's like a metaphor for, so I actually think McGill has a lot of people of color.
Okay.
But they're like the world's like wealthy class from like the, who have like hundreds of thousands of dollars of disposable income because their dad's like an oil empire giant, but they're not white. Like they are the collaborate. They are like the international business class. And it, even like the black people are, I find like very, even if the black people from the Caribbean, I'm like, okay, but they're from like the gated communities.
The affluent Caribbean.
In the Caribbean that like my auntie like goes to clean. So sometimes I'm like, you want to have a connection, but then you're like, okay, but you have like more money than like those white people I grew up with in St. Catharines, like times two. So it's weird. It's like this, mm-hmm. it's like, I see melanin, like mm-hmm. I see brown skin. I see like non-European features, but not so much in law. I will say I'm in the law school, but when I was an undergrad, I remember like I always struggled to find a connection with the people of color often because I was like, oh, but we have a completely different experience, even though we're both like, even if we both acknowledge that there was like, you know, like two like issues of marginalization in terms of race, it kind of stopped there. And I think it does kind of shape, like, if you're coming always from racism with the assumption that you will always have resources, it's not connected to your like your position as being disenfranchised from your like economic circumstance, I think that impacts like how you formulate your ideas and how you even present yourself or how deep it goes for you, because at the end of the day you don't need to worry about where your meals are coming from.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, this is like kind of what I wanted to talk about as well, but I kind of just skimmed over it.
No, but you did kind of talk about when you said like cosmopolitanism, because I think that is a model of cosmopolitanism, right? Where you have like, you know, so people speak there's like different languages and different cultures and different bodies, and it is diverse. It's not that it's lacking, but it's like a specific type of diversity that's non-threatening, right? That doesn't like really challenge anything, that just brings like continental, like people from like the subcontinent and people from the East and the Middle East.
So just to be able to say, yes, we are a diverse community, but not really,
because we're international. Diverse,
because you don't really tackle all socioeconomic classes.
Yeah, or like not diversity, not from the standpoint of like equity and social justice, just from the standpoint of like, look at how many countries are represented, and like now we can have like African food at like our next event because there are people from like.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess it also just goes to speak, because I mean, like, at grad, it was just the most interesting thing to see. Like,
Mercedes,
I mean,
graduated this year. Yeah, that's what she's talking about.
Just sitting there and just be able to be like, I can just count the faces. Like, if I can sit there and count, that's a problem. That's just a problem for me. And even, like, looking up on the stage with, like, the teachers, there was one, wow. Two. Two, you know, as you say, melanin faces. Like, that was about it. 10 of us crossed stage, and like you can identify.
10?
I counted.
In the
10.
Faculty of arts.
Well, art. It was arts, religion, all of that. Like,
oh wow,
like that many, and I swear to you, it was like I counted 10, and then there were some Native Americans who did graduate with me. I don't know if some just didn't show up for. Right. Convocation, but the ones who did, it was just like, hey, we made it. It literally is one of those moments where they say, just go up there to say that we can. And it was just incredible to be like, yeah, like you said, it's not to say that we're not at McGill, but when you sit in an auditorium, it makes you actually sit there and be like, where are we?
Right.
Because it's crazy. Like, among the masses, we are very much invisible.
Wow.
And I also wanted to point out, like, when I say like whiteness, it's not necessarily like just white people, but kind of the entire ideology or like all the discourses that come with that. And like, you can be a person of color impacted by whiteness. And like, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like walking around campus, I feel like that immense whiteness really, like, it pervades. It totally like saturates the air at McGill. Do we have any more time? I have one more question if you guys wanted to talk.
Sure. Okay. Why not? It's a free for all over here. You guys are breaking my tech rules.
Sorry. Okay, so I went to actually another workshop about white space, and I think I like almost got into a fight with a white guy. So I'm going to talk about safe spaces and challenging norms of unbridled safety within discourses on race and privilege. Go.
I never but can I just say, I actually was just talking to my friend about this today, like, in terms of like institutions of higher learning, I never assume they're safe. And it doesn't matter if it's like a workshop on a campus that's designed for the purposes of creating safe space. I would never walk in assuming safe space. And that's because of like going through years of those safe space workshops and then feeling horrible afterwards because I felt so violated by usually a white guy. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. And my friend was pushing back and kind of saying, well, I want to believe in a world like where it's possible to have education that has safe space for people of color. And I was like, all right, girl, good luck with that. I don't know.
I haven't given up.
It's an ideal.
It's like more of this idea of like safe space. What does that mean? And like, why can't it also be unsafe? You know what I mean? Like, why
can't safe space be unsafe?
Unsafe for people who hold a position of privilege. Because it's like, when you say safe space, it's like, you know, everyone be nice to each other, even though there's like a flaming a-hole in the corner talking. I can't swear on air, and this really like cuts down the
self-expression.
Yeah, the self-expression, because I have
this is an institutionalized space.
A limited
it's
vocabulary
safe from
here.
Your violent language.
Yeah, so I don't know.
I'm witty Victoria.
Well, but it's also like the politics of like the term safe space, right? Like everything is politicized, so. If, like, I remember, you know how education is kind of like the badass faculty? That's why they're trying to shut it down. So I saw this education syllabus, and it was like, this class begins with a set of assumptions. And then it's like, one, this is a settler colonial nation founded by genocidal. Two, like, the transatlantic slave trade was real and it has long enduring manifestations. It was just basically like what is racism 101, like 10 points.
This was an education.
It was an education what seminar class? On like, I think it was like critical race theory, but taught by like a PhD student. And why did I bring that up? I just remember thinking like, well, to me that's a much safer space, but I mean, then if you're like a class privileged person, if you're a white person, if you're a cis, if you're all of these things and you're not ready to unpack that, you could argue that that's very hostile and unsafe. But it's because it's like that term has become almost like it's almost I think sometimes when we talk about these things, we need to just use better language, because safe space, that's not what we really mean. What we mean is like anti-colonial, anti-racist, anti-sexist. You know, like that's what we mean, but that takes too long and you have to do like intersectionality. So then you just say like safe space. But it opens up the space for jerks who want to just spout some neoliberal crap and like, you know, wave their penis at you metaphorically. It opens up the opportunity for them to appropriate that term. That's why I don't know. Like, I just, ugh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm almost 30, so I think I'm changing.
No, that's exactly where I wanted to take this. And you basically summed it all up in very eloquent language. Thank you.
No problem.
Grace found it on. Two-thirds a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black race founded on blatant denial, squeeze economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Black rage is founded on wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Black race founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse, while we waited and waited. Spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on training and training, finding your freedom to stop your complaining, poisoning your water while they say it's raining. You're mad for complaining. Progress of humans.
contortion. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. When the dogs bite, when the beatings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't feel so bad.
That was Black Rage by Lauryn Hill. There's plenty to be raged about. Enraged about. This is Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 6:47. We're going to do stuff we love, stuff we hate right now, because we have to talk about hate today, because
we should just talk about hate instead of talking about things we love.
No, because love is important.
I'm a cynic.
I am too, but love is still important. So check this out, people. You guys all know about this. Well, you should know about this. Late Monday night, it was announced by District Attorney Bob McCullough that Darren Wilson, Officer Darren Wilson, who was responsible for shooting Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri on August 9th, was not, and District Attorney McCullough announced that Darren Wilson would not be indicted. The grand jury convened for 3 months. There were, I think, six white Americans and there were six white Americans and three African Americans who made up the grand jury. And people across the world, not just across the U.S., but across the world, are outraged. And this is the thing that I'm going to zero in on hating this day and this month. Yesterday, Gao and I went to a vigil on the lower campus at McGill that was supposed to be at the Rada Gates, but so many people showed up that they moved it to the lower field at McGill. And it was somber. The atmosphere was very, I think, tamed and calmed, and just wanted to show respect for the death of Mike Brown, because I think it's a tragedy, but we still have to talk about the fact that Black Lives Matter, because apparently, unless you say that, people just assume that they don't, given the fact that it seems to be open season on Black life, and the cops are at ground zero of that.
Open smash right there.
And I'm just, I don't know, like, I'm very somber today, because I actually was crying a lot last night, because I went home and I watched a lot of the footage of, I saw the interview that Darren Wilson gave, and just even like the language, his test, and the language of the grand jury testimony that he gave to the grand jury in defense of himself, essentially, is like so super racist and laden with all of these really disgusting, you know. I think he called Mike Brown a demon at one point. He said he felt like he was a 5-year-old boy against Hulk Hogan. This is a police officer in a car shooting an unarmed child, a child who was going to go to college, who was 18 years old. He was a boy wearing basketball shorts and a cap, walking on the street with his friend. You feel like he's Hulk Hogan and you're a 5-year-old child with your armored, like, I just, the... It's almost like you almost sometimes don't even want to go into the facts, because it's so simple. It's just like, you see a black person, you see someone with dark skin, you know you can get away with murdering them if you're a police officer. It happens all the time. And I'm not even just saying that the only people who view black life with suspicion of criminality inherently are police officers. It's just because this is a state arm, the protections afforded to them are so much more. But we can see the impunity across the board. I mean, this obviously, I think, is getting a lot of media attention because it comes so closely after the Trayvon Martin murder by George Zimmerman that was also not punished. So what do you guys think? Sorry, I went on a rant.
No, it was necessary. I don't know, it was just very, very disappointing. It just feels like no matter how many of these young men have to die, it's just the whole court procedure is just for show, just to say, like, yes, we are looking into this. And then what, 3 weeks later, another one has a 12-year-old right now?
Yeah, in Cincinnati.
Are you serious?
In Cincinnati, I know.
Right after all of this happened, a 12-year-old.
I know.
Was that the child that was in an abandoned house?
No, he was in the park and he was waving like a toy gun. Yeah. But the dispatcher had said they think it's a 12-year-old shot in the stomach twice.
Yep.
And the first instinct was to pull your trigger.
He's 12.
Like, unbelievable.
That happened, like, last month, too, with another guy holding, like, weekend. A toy gun in a store.
In Walmart.
Yeah.
On Saturday. So you had, this happened Saturday, the no indictment on Tuesday, and then, like, what's next? Like, what's going to happen next month? Because it just seems like every week there's something.
Yeah, and I also wanted to comment on the portrayal of the people in Ferguson as kind of unruly rioters. There's a really good quote by Dr. Martin Luther King that Amy Goodman was talking about on Democracy Now! She was talking about riots as the voice, as
the unheard.
The language of the unheard. Yeah. And I'm just really tired of even, like, liberal outlets or outlets that are claiming to be objective. I'm not even talking about, like, explicitly partisan media, just spouting off this crap about how, given the fact that the only people who have been killed in these situations are Black people by the state, these are people who work for the state, who are paid with taxpayer money, mm-hmm. that somehow property damage, like petty property damage, it's like broken windows is like so much more horrific than the fact that children are getting killed by the state. Or by state people operating with the backing of the state and duties that are supposed to be to protect the communities. And it's just it's like as if your child getting killed, you being terrorized by police forces for decades and, like, finally erupting into some kind of, like, look, this is – I don't feel like the democratic system we have is responsive to my needs, so I need to say something. As if that's the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, not the fact that we have, like, an explicitly racist criminal justice system in North America. Not the fact that it's pretty much impossible to indict a police officer for doing anything involving mishandling any situation involving a Black person. Mm-hmm. None of that. That's all off. That's all fine. And this is not even a partisan issue. Like, Eric Holder's comments I found really gross, especially since he went to Ferguson after the protest started to tell them, have faith in the legal system, have faith in the justice system. So what did people do? They had faith in the justice system
and it failed them again.
You know what I'm saying? And so then to come out and say, oh, we can't have, like, property damage. Like, when did property become more important than children? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's actually a really, like, controversial question, apparently, even though it's 2014, because, like, I can't.
No, but
I don't even want to talk about Obama. I can't. I couldn't even listen to what he was saying.
I didn't watch it.
You know, like, every time it's like anytime he talks about race, he adopts this thing about, like, he wants to say stuff, but he has to be like, you know, communities of color aren't just making this up. It's like, we know. Like, you need to not say it like that. Like, who are you speaking to when you say something like that?
Not us.
Like, and stop acting like if you just say it in the nicest possible way, somehow the half of America that wants you dead, I'm not saying it's that many people, but, like, the faction of America that just wakes up every morning angry at the fact that the president of the United States is Black, as if, like, you'll win some of those over. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand. Like, at this point, you know, and even First Lady Obama, like, I'm sorry to say, I'm not saying that she could single-handedly, like, bring some, you know, voices to bear on this, but it would just be nice if one of them, like, broke ranks or did something. Like, they have nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. But of course they won't.
Well, what? Yeah, it's really sad. There's a really good article I circulated on the listserv today. I'm inviting our listeners to check it out. It's just the Washington Post. It's an opinion piece. Forget who it's by. It's all about white rage and, like, systemic oppression, and this is really about white rage, and it's not about, you know, Black rage and, like, you know, rioters, and, you know, we need to look at, you know, all these different forms of systemic, like, violence and abuse from that point of view. Props to my colleague Emma for sending me that link. Sorry, did I interrupt, Mercedes? Were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say that despite what we hate about what happened, for example, I do love is the rage.
I love the rage. It's so reasonable.
So I'd say it's, I don't know.
And I
it's
love refreshing. Those young people. They're like, it's apparently like freezing cold right now. And they're out there every
stand
day.
Stand up for what you believe in, man. Just do it with dignity. But, you know, if you have to break a few windows, you have to break a few windows, you know?
Oh, wait, that's my answer to your question before, Victoria. Break windows.
Break windows.
Never mind.
Okay.
What else do we look at? Let's finish on a positive.
Excuse moi.
What else do we love?
Est-ce que vous savez?
Well, I think it's that time of the show where, you know, we have to say goodbye.
Is it?
Yeah, it is.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, okay. Oh, Spitfire Women of Color broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio, 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check us out at spitfire.blogspot.com, although that blog hasn't been updated in a minute, just saying.
So basically don't check out the blog.
Sorry, I think that has like some stuff from 2008 as if that was just yesterday. Also, follow us on Twitter at Spitfire Radio.
Peace. Here it is, no copy, my progress. Keep my progress. Here it is, no copy, my progress. He took her to the Louvre Paris. You want a chance with a younger, want a brew with a wave. You want a juniper, please. To get the grands and a harness and a shoe with the bleed. To fit the grands and a harness and a little to defeat. High class, no school, the tuition is free. Little BM, no fool, intuition is cheap. Give me the gym or the juice, I commission a fee. I make hits, motherfucker, never do it for free. Huh? Young tender from the NYC. No contender, none in my league. Young killer in the denims, young venom on the MIC. Young villain been developing the heat that's thick. Elite rap, bitch, I call it in the beat that quick. Tip tipping on these niggas, suck if he got shit. Cause you gon' be a bitch, nigga, I'ma be that bitch. What? Maybe I recite in the raw, the appetite for life and the hunger for the more. The island of Manhattan, I was born in New York. City never slumbers, I would always dream and never sleep to the hundreds. Cocoa with the cream and abundance. $1 million baby, you could get it if you wanted.